You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht, Benjamin Pieske, and Sam Gardner, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, we are talking about challenges and opportunities of combining real-world evidence and randomized clinical trial data, or other clinical trial data. Really hot topic, so stay tuned for this one. I've been working on real-world evidence data for quite a long time. Most of my career I worked on it. And of course I also worked on clinical trial data. And 20 years ago we would have never thought about merging them together. But there's a lot of opportunities if we actually do this. And today I'm really happy to talk with our guest about this. So stay tuned and learn more about it. Speaking of learning, there's a lot you can learn from PSI, which is the association I'm running this podcast with. It's a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. You can learn via the Video On Demand Content Library about the free registration to all PSI webinars if you're a PSI member, and many, many more activities, including the flagship conference in 2022, which will happen hopefully live in Gothenburg. Head over to PSI at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to a new episode of The Effective Statistician. Today, I'm really happy to speak with Thomas. Thomas, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing well, thank you.
Very good. Today, we are talking about real-world evidence, frameworks, HTA. How did you come into that area?
I think that's been a long road because I've been in academia for quite a couple of years now. And initially I did, of course, a PhD like any other academic, and my PhD was about prognosis and meta-analysis. And so I worked on methodology for integrating some kind of concepts and methodologies that has commonly been used in intervention research for summarizing evidence into a different area. But for me, it kind of opened a new perspective, because I started to understand, okay, what are the developments in this space of evidence synthesis, and how can it not only contribute to learning about treatment effect estimates, but also improving risk predictions. And so this kind of experience opened up new pathways for me to embark on new projects. And one of the projects I started working on sometime after my PhD was iMyGetReal, where basically the focus was on combining evidence from both randomized and non-randomized settings. And this is the kind of project where, the luggage or the experience that I gained and developed the years before became really handy to explore how these kind of standard methods can be further extended and be leveraged for more advanced kind of questions. And so I would say, so I think that the key points that I started working with this kind of methodology, I think it was really iMyGetReal where I really made a lot of efforts to better understand about these topics.
So if you talk about combining clinical trials and real-world evidence or observational data, what kind of observational data are you thinking about?
Yeah, so this can be, this is a very broad question, right? Because typically observational studies in the field of epidemiology, we think indeed about observational studies, right? About pre-designed
prospective studies
that, are designed to answer intervention questions. And so, of course, in the ideal case, this would kind of be the ideal observational study, right? Where you've designed your study in a way to collect all the information that you need to address your effectiveness or efficacy questions, where you collect all the informational confounders that you think are important, where you collect information on the outcomes that you think are important, where you build in enough, moments to, collect follow-up information and so forth. So this is a kind of the ideal case for doing a kind of observational study to think about intervention effects. And so, I mean, this is certainly one of the options and one of the possibilities that how you could use observational data in combination with randomized data. But the reality is, of course, that there are many other types of observational data out there that are maybe less ideal, less you know, more complicated to use for the same kind of purposes. But nevertheless, they might still contain information that can help you to better understand how certain interventions or drugs work outside a clinical trial setting, or also in settings when you don't have randomized evidence available so far. So how do I see observational data or non-randomized data? So I see it as a much bigger type of bucket of evidence, right? So it can also be observational studies that have not been designed for answering intervention questions, but for maybe some other type of purposes. So they could still have been prospective, but for a whole different, they could have been set up for a whole different purpose. But nevertheless, there might be, you know, information in those studies that could still allow you to investigate treatment effect estimates to a certain degree. And then also nowadays, also you have increasingly often you have data available from, for instance, registries with routine care data. So it's even more, of course, it's even more challenging to use this data to learn about treatment effects. But in some situations, it's certainly possible. But of course, it comes with certain caveats that you could avoid, of course, if you design a prospective study.
Yeah, a prospective study, if you know what you actually need, always has much better quality because it's fit for purpose. Whereas if you have something, you know, secondary, it always comes with problems. How about the one-armed cases? So if you would have data that comes only from a one-armed study, you have a one-armed clinical trial maybe, or one-armed observational study, would that also be part of your considerations?
Yes. So of course you can use like trial in detail where you only have like one arm, and then you could indeed look for observational data to kind of supplement these data as a kind of control arm. So yeah, I mean, it's in the same kind of space, at least from my, you know, my point of view. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think it belongs in the same kind of area it's not necessarily a synthesis, right? Because you just have then two arms. If you just have like one comparator arm and one control arm, there is not really any synthesis going on. But yeah, conceptually, it's the same kind of problems that you're struggling with. And maybe, of course, if you have access to multiple control arms or multiple observational data, or maybe even multiple active comparator arms, then maybe you have some, you generate some possibilities also to investigate to what extent these groups that you're using, to what extent they are, I don't know, generalizable to other populations and other settings. So you create some new opportunities to learn about, to some extent, the validity of the strategy that you're pursuing, but also to learn about the generalizability of these effects that you're estimating, and to investigate. And it creates also opportunities to investigate, you know, if there are discrepancies, what could be possible reasons for this. So
when you talk about validity, what do you understand by that?
That's a challenging question, right? Because validity, validity, I think in technical terms, it relates to bias, right? So it's the estimate that you're trying to quantify, is the estimate that you're trying to quantify, does it represent, I mean, the estimate that you get out of it, is it accurate, right? Is the number, the statistic that you get out, is it you know, is it the true number that we should be getting out of this analysis? So, but that's of course a kind of theoretical term. And just to come back to your question, so what I mean with validity, I usually refer to bias, but in practice, of course, bias may sometimes be a complex terminology, because now actually you have all this discussion about use of estimates indeed, and depending on how you define, you know, your research question, very, you know, subtle nuances may lead to very different estimates sometimes, not always, but sometimes it may lead to different estimates. And so the question is, how do you interpret these estimates? So, and in the past, I guess we haven't always put that much, you know, attention to this kind of subtleties, and maybe often it didn't really make a big difference. But yeah, when you talk about bias, it can make quite a difference, right? So the way, if you misinterpret certain estimates, so either you might call it, okay, my estimate is biased, or you might just say that, look, you're just not interpreting your statistics in the right way.
Yeah. So in the way that biases always depends on the estimate. Yeah. An estimate for one estimate would be unbiased, and for another estimate, it would be biased.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So in terms of biases, where is this bias all coming from in this type of research where we combine clinical and observational data? What are typical sources of bias?
Yeah, of course, for non-randomized studies, I think one of the most common sources of bias is confounding, right? Where you have other variables or characteristics that are also affecting the outcome, but also affecting the treatment allocation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the most common biases that has been widely studied and mentioned as a key source of concern.
So that is, for example, the case if, let's say, you have two treatments, one works better in females than the other, and then you have for that treatment, you also have an overallocation of females.
Yes.
And of course, that the overall treatment effect looks much bigger than if you would have the same allocation for gender allocation for the two treatments. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, of course, a common problem, right? In non-randomized settings where, of course, treatment allocation is not random, right? I mean, treatment allocation is driven by many, many factors, that expectations about whether the treatment will work, maybe also some convenience, you know, reasons on you know, that maybe could even relate to safety issues or other, you know, kind of aspects. But yeah, I would be surprised. I don't know if there are examples where somehow there are certain treatments that are kind of quasi-randomized, allocated in clinical practice, maybe for some interventions that, I don't know, that don't really have a strong effect. I don't know, like a paracetamol, I don't know. It's just a random comment. I really don't have a clue.
But, yeah. What are other sources of bias?
Yeah, so other sources. So yeah, the quality of the measurements can also lead to bias. So I know in randomized trials, they're heavily controlled, right? So there's a lot of effort making sure that you measure the right thing in the right way at the right time. So there is a lot of emphasis on the quality of the measurements. Mm-hmm. And this is much less the case in observational research, where sometimes, I mean, so data can be collected through questionnaires, but also they can be collected, how do you say that? It's like a part of clinical routine, right? So you would ask like a doctor or a physician to participate in your study and to just share your data. And you would trust them to, you know, collect the data in a meaningful way. But it's possible that, you know, they don't have much time to, you know, help you with all the different questions. So they might take a measurement a bit, not at the exact moment where you would like it to be taken. Or they might sometimes, you know, they see a patient and they think, look, I don't need that information. I already know it's problematic. Something like, I don't know, like smoking history or something like that. You know, like, okay, look, this patient, I know he smokes. I'm not going to ask all these questions about how much he smokes or when he smokes. So the some information may be less accurate, or it may not even be collected. Like missing data is also much more common in observational studies. And then the timing of the measurements. So of course, yeah, so typically the measurements are taken at a contact moment, right? So when you see the patient, so their timing may not always be an issue, but sometimes the characteristics of the patient or the measurements may be not taken at the contact moment, but they may be, I don't know, retrieved from like indeed like a register or some other kind of source, or maybe retrospectively through a questionnaire. And so these are also kind of examples where the information that you intend to collect, that there is a mismatch between the actual data that you get. But sometimes you know there is a mismatch and sometimes you don't have a clue.
It could be, for example, that in a clinical trial, you're asked, you know, after 12 weeks of treatment, every patient comes in, and the time window beyond and before this 12-week visit is very, very small. Yeah, so in a clinical trial, maybe just a couple of days. Whereas in an observational study, it could be much wider. Yeah, so maybe you have patients that were coming in much earlier and other patients that were coming in much later. And so that by itself already drives much more kind of variability in the observational. How does that affect the treatment difference then? If you have one compared to the other?
That's really hard to say. I think, I mean, what's common, so I know with in the presence of measurement error, so it's people or researchers often, you know, like they mention, like in a discussion, they have like a short sentence where it would say something like, we know that there is measurement error. And we expect that this will dilute whatever estimates that we're trying to obtain. But I mean, in practice, I mean, so several studies have shown that it can go either way. You know, it can lead to dilution, but it can also go the other way. So it's really hard to to anticipate how the presence of measurement error, but also differential measurement error. So when the amount and magnitude and so forth of your error differs between groups and maybe treatment arms, at least from my experience, really hard to say how this will affect your results. But in general, it might lead to bias, but also to problems with standard errors and precision and so forth.
Yeah, I can understand if you have, let's say, within a clinical study, you have a measurement error for a certain covariate. The bigger the measurement error, the smaller the effect of the covariate by design. That's always the case. But the problem is if you have this differential thing, that for one treatment arm you have captured it very precisely, and for the other treatment arm you have more measurement error, then I think it's kind of a really difficult thing, because then you don't really know in which direction it goes. Is that that case?
So I don't know the exact situations where it just lead to dilution. I know there are certain situations indeed where you can prove that it only dilutes the effect. But so we've mostly looked at more sophisticated scenarios. So we recently did a study where we looked at an IP, so a meta-analysis setting where we have data from multiple like observational studies and mostly observational studies. But then, for instance, the quality of those observational studies varies. So different observational studies have different quality of measurement and different variability measurement error, but also a different amount of bias in the measurements. And so these were already, I mean, it was already too complex to have like a single answer on how it affects estimates. But of course, we have to realize that for intervention studies, the main estimate that we are interested in is the treatment effect. And so where the bias would then be coming from is rather the confounder adjustment, right? When we have a measurement error in confounding variables. But I can imagine, so if you have like differential measurement error in certain confounder variables, you might observe effects that are not really there. Or the other way around, you might observe very strong effects that actually are in reality are much weaker, but because there is this kind of differential error going on, you know, it could distort a lot of signals in the analysis that you're trying to undertake.
Yeah, completely see that. So was this real world evidence event earlier this year, earlier in 2021, talk a little bit about this and your learnings from it.
So you have to remind me which specific event this.
You had this event in July where there was a panel discussion and so on.
Oh, right. Yes. So indeed. So this is a panel discussion we set up as a kind of a follow-up of two papers that we wrote together with the ISPE special interest group on comparative effectiveness research. Mm-hmm. So in this panel, we had a discussion about the use of non-randomized evidence for health technology assessment and decision making. We kind of touched upon what is the current situation, what are the possibilities of leveraging real world evidence, but also how can we leverage real world evidence in a way that that's not only analytically possible, but also in a way that it would be accepted for health technology assessment bodies and maybe other authorities that require evidence to make decisions on a more global level. So what exactly would you like to know about
what? In terms of the HTA acceptance, what's your perception with this real world, this more sophisticated, newer methodology of combining observational studies and clinical trials?
Yeah, so my impression is that, I mean, different stakeholders have an interest in, making more use of real world evidence. And the big question is how you can do that in a way that is valid, but also in a way that it's, that you can make, decisions that are consistent with each other, that for the same type of evidence and the same type of quality of evidence, you make the same decisions. And that's, of course, much harder for evidence that is partly based on non-randomized data, because there are much more differences in not only in the quality of the data, but in the way how you can analyze this data. So at this moment, as far as I know, there is not really any kind of formal guidance on how to do this analysis. So we try to make a first step by publishing a framework for an analytical framework for, you know, obtaining real-world evidence and for deciding which kind of methods would be more appropriate for analyzing the evidence. So we try to make a first step in this direction. But I understand that a lot more effort is needed to kind of harmonize the efforts that would be needed to, you know, to present like an evidence package on certain interventions that are both comprised of randomized and non-randomized evidence, or even that are not even based on randomized evidence. So, yeah, my impression is that there are possibilities, there is a demand, but we've not reached a phase where you know, we have like a standardized procedure for dealing with these challenges.
Yeah. My perception would be the first countries that probably would be interested in would be England, is nice. And I'm saying specifically England and not Great Britain, because there's a couple of other stakeholders in the United Kingdom as well. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I don't know how other countries are looking into this space, but I know, of course, NICE, I know they recently published, a document also, I think, where they highlighted the possibility of real-world evidence, and I think where they made a kind of a call for methods. Although I don't know the details, I would have to look that up. But I see that indeed NICE would be, at least my impression is that they're interested to look into these possibilities. Mm-hmm. But I might be wrong. So I'm not a member of NICE, so of course you might better.
Yeah, it's always great to check the latest technical support documents there and guidances and publications from those people that work on the corresponding technical groups that consult NICE. So these are the common people from the different universities, especially in the UK. Very good. So we talked quite a lot about different areas of how we can combine real-world trials and clinical trials. And there's a lot of new advances in there, how we can combine them, how we can make best use of all the available evidence, not just only rely on clinical trials, and how that can enrich it. I think it's also a really hot topic in the regulatory space, because enriching clinical trials with observational data, enriching clinical trials with other sources of data, both for efficacy and safety, is a really hot topic. And so I think it's currently a scenario where we both in the HDA area, but also in the real world evidence in the regulatory area, we are working on this on similar things. So thanks so much for this really, really great discussion. I think that helped a lot to understand kind of where problems are coming from, that observational data is not equal observational data. It really depends on what study you're looking into, and that there's still quite a lot of things to do, but it's an amazing field and a very, very hot topic. Thomas, is there anything that is key that you would like to have as a takeaway for the listener?
A key takeaway, I think so. At least, my impression is that there is a lot of opportunities in the use of real world data, but it comes also with certain challenges and certain dangers. So caution is warranted in this area. But regardless, I'm optimistic about this, you know, taking this direction, and I'm really excited about this, you know, because it opens up so many more doors, especially in spaces where, you know, we need to consider other types of evidence. My thought is let's embrace these opportunities and just be careful how we make use of these opportunities. So that, I think that would be my takeaway.
Yeah, completely agree with that. Thanks so much, Thomas. Have a good time.
Thank you. Thank you.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team, who helps with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about this podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health area. Reach your potential. lead great science and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.